We're in chapter 7, and what I'm going to do this evening is, I'm not going to do a big reading, if you like, of it. We'll just kind of read verses as we come to them. So if you've got your Bibles, it would be worth having them open at chapter 7. We're in chapter 7 and chapter 8, and Colette, the preacher, the person that we hear in this book returns to the theme of wisdom again. And in these two chapters, the basic argument that he makes is this. He says, wisdom is good. It's good. It helps us to live well, but it has its limits. What he does is he makes this point by exploring three things: death, unanswerable questions, and the abuse of power. Now, those are three nice, cheery subjects to think about on a Sunday evening in May. But before we get into it, I need to confess something. I really wrestled with these two chapters in Ecclesiastes. And back at the start of our series, you might remember me saying that this is a difficult book to understand. And these two chapters are amongst the most difficult to understand. Just to illustrate my point, I read four different commentaries this week in preparing. And all four commentaries took slightly different approaches to the text. So all of that's to say, that if you disagree with my interpretation of these verses, that's probably okay. But I'm not saying anything particularly controversial, so I don't think anyone will have a problem from a doctrinal point of view. But here is what God has laid on my heart this week for us to look at. Let's look at these three things in turn. So firstly, living wisely with the shadow of death. Then living wisely with unanswerable questions. And then thirdly, living wisely when power is abused. Now, if you've been here before, you'll know, because I've already made use of them in my illustrations, that we have two pets. We've got a dog and a cat. And maybe some of you are rolling your eyes. Oh no, here he goes with the pets again. But they do make really good sermon illustrations, so I'm really sorry if you feel that way, but I'm going to keep using them. Anyway, now Bambi is our kitten, and often she does that thing that cats do. You know, if you've got a cat, you'll know what they do. They kind of lurk. They lurk in the shadows. Now, we find her behind doors and on top of cupboards and in cupboards and behind curtains and once, believe it or not, in an empty box of bran flakes. Sometimes it's really cute, sometimes it's a little bit scary when you see something moved out of the corner of your eye, but sometimes it's funny, and it's particularly funny when her lurking turns to stalking, and the poor victim is our little puppy, Lucy, and the dog will be minding her own business, chewing her bone, and then out of nowhere, this cat will either jump over the top of her or run up and do this with her tail and then run away or something like that. And in the first 12 verses that we have in chapter 7, we have this section that wouldn't really look out of place if it were in the book of Proverbs. You have a list of Proverbs. But lurking behind the doors and on top of cupboards, not just of these verses, but the preacher says of life itself, is death. It's there. It's always there in the shadows. And it's not just lurking. It's stalking you, ready to jump out and stare you in the face. What does the preacher say about death? Look at the end of verse 1. The preacher says, the day of death is better than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. Now we read this and we go, on earth are you talking about? How can this possibly be true? How can it possibly be better to go to a funeral instead of a party celebrating a newborn baby? Here we do that thing that we Brits like to do when someone we think has lost it. We kind of go, okay. But look at the next bit. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. What's he saying? He's saying you'll learn much more from a funeral than you will from a party. Now, think for a moment. What was the last thing that you learnt about yourself? What deep truth did you learn about yourself at a party? I think the last thing I learnt at a party, that it is possible for me to eat too much meat. I'd hardly call that a life-defining moment. But a funeral can be life-defining. I remember bumping into a man when we were serving tea and coffee in Aberdeen outside of our church. And this man had just become a Christian. And his journey towards Jesus had started at the funeral of one of his friends at another church in the city, and he hadn't seen this friend for years. And the last time that he'd seen him, he thought, well, he was just exactly the same as him. They were both drug addicts. They were considered down and outs by society, people who they didn't much care for. And he went to this church, and he was blown away, because the first thing that surprised him was the church was full. And the second thing that surprised him was the atmosphere, because although there was mourning and there was sadness, there was something different. There was this sense of who on earth was going on here. Well, he asked someone, is this the right funeral? Am I at the right funeral? And oh yes, he was at the right funeral. And what had happened is that his friend who had just died had become a Christian 18 months before his death. And that the church had embraced him as part of the family. And when he heard this, he was blown away. And he said to himself, that's something that I want in my life. And so he started to come along to this church. And eventually, he had become a Christian. And in verses 3 and 4 of chapter 7, he shows us that there are two ways to respond to death, really. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. Again, we ask the question, well, how can it possibly be better to suffer than to laugh? Is the preacher just being a stoic here? He's being a bit morbid, a bit boring. Is he really saying that the best way to live is to be miserable all day, every day, wear black, eat gruel, never have fun, go to every wake that there is and cry your eyes out? Well, I don't think that is what he's saying. If you remember back in chapter 3, verse 4, we have that famous passage about there being a time for everything. And he says there, verse 4 of chapter 3, a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. I don't think he is against parties or having a good laugh. What he is against, what he says is foolish, is only doing these things. And doing them to escape the cold, hard reality of life. That it's hard, that life is hard, that there is pain, that there is suffering, and ultimately that you will die. The mindless pursuit of frivolity won't help you learn anything. But the wise person embraces the reality of death and of suffering, and he learns through it and in the face of it. Preacher gives us some examples of the sorts of things that you learn when you are wise. The first thing is about character. Look at verse 1. A good name is better than precious ointment. Now this, apparently if you read it in the Hebrew, this is a play on words. The word for name and the word for ointment are similar. But his point is simple, isn't it? It's better to have a good reputation than to look and smell good. There's a scene at the end of Saving Private Ryan, if you've ever seen it, where having had his life saved by a company sent to rescue him, they all die. The captain, with his dying words, turns to Private Ryan and he says, "Earn it." Then it cuts to a graveyard, and now a much older Private Ryan falls to his knees before the captain's grave and, sobbing, says to his wife, not, "Tell me I look good for my age." He says, "Tell me I've lived a good life." When we confront death, we don't much care about how we look. We care about how we have lived. And later in verses 7 to 10, the preacher tells us the sort of character which we should want. In those verses, he says we should want to be someone who's just and honest and patient and humble and slow to anger. So that's character. And then secondly, company, look at verse 5. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fools. Now, what sort of company do you keep? That's the sort of question that the preacher is asking. And when I think of laughing fools, the picture, and this probably shows what sort of movies I grew up on as a child, but the thing that comes into my mind is the hyenas in The Lion King, if you've ever seen it. Do you know who I mean? They're always giggling, they're always laughing. They're a bit stupid. But they're yes men, aren't they? They're always doing what Scar wants them to do. But what Scar really needs is someone to stand up to him and tell him that his attitude is wrong. People who agree with you, people who laugh at all your jokes, even though they aren't funny, are like thorns used for kindling. They make a lot of noise and smoke, but it's not long before they disappear. What's he saying? He's saying there will be no lasting impact on you because you won't be challenged to change. It's much wiser to have friends who tell you when you're wrong, and it might hurt. You might not like what they have to say to you, but it will help you live a better life. So that's character and company. And the third thing is clock. Verse 10, "Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this." How many conversations have you heard that start like this? "When I was young, when I was a boy, in the good old days." We love to look at the past through rose-tinted spectacles, don't we? It was all so much better back then, so much simpler, so much happier. And we do it as Christians as well. We look back and say how much better it was in the good old days when the whole country stood for Christian values. The preacher says, these are his words, "For it is not from wisdom that you ask this." What's he saying? Well, he's saying it's a stupid question. He's saying it's a foolish question. The wise person does not live in the past because, having confronted suffering and looked death in the face, he realizes the past is the past. It's done. The only thing we can do is shape our present and so shape our future. There's a song by a Northern Irish guy called Robin Mark. You may have come across him before. And he kind of does exactly this. He imagines himself at the end of his life in this song. And there's a recurring question in the song that says this: when it's all been said and done, there is just one thing that matters. Did I do my best to live for truth? That I live my life for you. Robin Mark, like us, lives post-Jesus. We've got a greater revelation of God in Jesus Christ. And so he knows that the sort of character the preacher says that we should pursue, that it's in Jesus that we find the ability to pursue that. And it's in him that we find the sort of company that wise people keep. And it's in him that we will find the will to live now and to hope for the future. So the question really for us to ponder first this evening is this. Do we know this Jesus? And are we living in light of him? Are we wise? Are we taking what the preacher says on here and living in light of Jesus? When we confront the reality of death, as Christians, it should move our minds to Jesus, who has paid the penalty for our death, who has defeated death itself. We should be moved to live in light of it. I wonder if it would be helpful if we just stopped for a moment and considered those things. Considered the type of character we pursue, the type of company that we keep, and the time that we live in. So let's just take a minute to let that kind of sink in and to chew over that, and then we'll move on to the second point. Okay, so that was living with the shadow of death. The second point, living with unanswerable questions. Now, you notice I'm distinguishing here between unanswerable questions and questions that are hard to answer. There's a big difference between those two. And the difference is that we can pursue the answers to difficult questions, but what we can't do in our wisdom is find answers to questions that there aren't answers for, that there aren't answers that we can find. Things that our wisdom, no matter how deep, no matter how filled with knowledge, just can't know, because they can't be fathomed, they can't be grasped by human minds. Now, the first is this. How can we fix our broken world? Look at verse 13. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? What's he saying here? Two things. So, firstly, what God does, no one can undo. Can't be done. And more specifically, he speaks about the curse that's brought on by the fall. Back in Genesis 3, we read all about it. We sinned. We were disobedient to God's command. We committed cosmic treason, and God curses the universe. Death comes into the world, everything gets more difficult, things are no longer the way they were designed to be. And our wisdom, no matter how deep, can change what we've broken. We can't fix our broken world. And secondly, what will happen in the future? Look at verse 14. In the day of prosperity, be joyful, and in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. So although the universe is crooked, the preacher said, God gives us good days and he gives us bad days. Because of that, no one can predict what's going to happen. God is in control. We are not in control. Don't waste your time trying to know the future. Enjoy the good days when they come and get through the bad. Third question. And the most difficult for us to deal with. Why do bad people live long lives and good people die young? Look at verse 15. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing. Bad things happen to good people, don't they? And good things happen to bad people. Good people die young, bad people die old, and we can't reason this out. We can't search the depths of our wisdom and say, this is why that happened to that person on this day. It's very tempting for us to do so. It's very tempting for us to be like Job's counselors and give him the reasons for the suffering. But it's really unhelpful. A good friend of mine up in Aberdeen suffers from depression and psychosis. And during a serious bout of this, she ended up in a hospital. And she's a very popular girl, so she had lots of visitors and well-wishers, but unfortunately she had a few people who came playing Job's counselors, coming to her in the midst of her suffering and telling her that there was some unconfessed sin in her life, or that she was possessed by a demon and needed to be exorcised. And that was deeply unhelpful. It was deeply damaging for her. And it was deeply foolish on their part. It's just not that simple. We can't pick and choose what the Bible says and then nail it on as the thing, as this thing or that thing. The reality is, to this day, I've got no idea. No idea why my friend went through what she went through. And she doesn't either. Wisdom just can't take us there. What's the preacher's solution to these problems? Verse 16. Be not overly righteous and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is better that you should take hold of this. And from that, withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. Now, at first reading, it's another one of those what on earth are you talking about moments. The preacher seems to be advocating some sort of middle way. Don't be too good, don't be too bad, and it will all be okay. But verse 18 seems to point to the fact that it's not a middle way that is required, but a different way altogether. Now, if you remember back to when we introduced this book, we talked about how the pursuing of these things that we're looking at, like wisdom and wealth and all of that, they're not bad pursuits in themselves. We talked about the problem being the motives behind their pursuit. We talked about the problems of that kind of consumeristic approach to things, where we use them to gain for ourselves. And that's what the preacher is reeling against here. It's self-righteousness. that he is having a problem with. It's arrogant wisdom that thinks it can know everything, can know all the answers to every problem. And he says something that might be shocking to those listening in. He says they're hevel, which is that word that we looked at, which means breath. He says they destroy in just the same way as wickedness and folly do. The different approach that is required is this. Did you see it in verse 18? Fear God. When life confronts us with the unanswerable questions, the preacher says, fear God. What does he mean? Well, I think he helps us in verse 20. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows many times you yourself have cursed others. All this I have tested by wisdom, said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been far off and deep, very deep, who can find out? It's foolish to think we can be so wise that we know how to behave in every situation. He says, look at your lives. It's clear that you don't. He says, even righteous people sin. Even righteous people are so sensitive to criticism that they criticize others. Wisdom won't get us there. We need to realize our own limitations. We are imperfect, and therefore, we just can't know everything. The pursuit of that is foolishness. Continues this theme in the next few verses, telling of what he found out about humans. This is what he said, verse 27. Behold, this is what I find, says the preacher, while adding one thing to another, to find the scheme of things which my soul sought repeatedly, but I have not found. One man among a thousand I find, but a woman among these I have not found. Now, these are some of the verses that there's a lot of debate about what they mean. And maybe it's because I like to keep things simple that I'm going for the most straightforward of the options. I think he's saying that people are bad. He looked at 1,000 people, he found one righteous man and no women. Some people have argued that the preacher is a misogynist. I'm not so sure that's the point. I think he's just speaking out of his own experience. Maybe he's had a bad experience of women, I don't know. But certainly out of the 1,000 people he looked at, he's saying, I just find one person, one man. Then he adds insult to injury, verse 29. See this alone I find, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. Now, he's echoing what we see in Genesis 3. Yes, it is God who curses the universe, but we are at fault, not him. We are the sinners. We are the ones committing cosmic treason. And we did so, how? By trying to be wise. That's what we did, isn't it? We took of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. We were trying to be as wise as God. But that is ridiculous. There are things we can't know. If we could know everything, then we would be like God. We need to stop playing God or stop attempting to play him. To accept the truth, there are questions we can't know the answers to, and that's okay. Because God knows. And it's the fact that God is greater than us that should lead us to fear. I love that picture of Aslan in Narnia. You know the one. Lucy asked one of the beavers, is it safe? Is he safe? And one of the beavers, can't remember which one it is, turns and kind of laughs and says, he's not safe, but he's good. See, God has breathtaking power, doesn't he? Power that should make our knees knock. But he also invites us to approach his throne of grace confidently in Jesus Christ. Now, one other point here that we just can't ignore about good people suffering, Christians suffering, it's a real stumbling block, isn't it, for a lot of people? And sure enough, there are cold-hearted theological answers that we could give to why things happen. But I just think that they're unhelpful in the moment. The only thing that helps, I think, in the midst of unexplainable suffering is to see the best man who has ever lived suffer. I heard Jesus unimaginably to suffer on that cross. You know, physical suffering. The Romans couldn't imagine a worse way to die. And then even worse than that, the spiritual suffering that's happening on the cross. And yet God uses it for the central point in his whole mission plan for the universe. It does the greatest good for us. And that, I think, is the reason I can trust that he can use what I can't explain for good. And that's true even if I never know what that good is. So I wonder if we should pause just for a moment and think on that. And then we'll go into our last bit. Okay, so we've had living wisely in the shadow of death, living wisely with unanswerable questions, and thirdly, living wisely when power is abused. And this is chapter 8. The preacher tackles this issue. Maybe isn't particularly clear at the start, but I think as we go on, this is it becomes more clear what he's talking about. Let's walk our way through the picture that he paints. Verse 2. He says, "Keep the king's command because of God's oath to him. Be not hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand in an evil cause, for he does whatever he pleases. For the word of the king is supreme, and who may say to him, 'What are you doing?'" The divine right of kings and rulers, that idea that God puts the kings and the rulers of this world into place, whether they're good or bad, is obviously a theme that runs right through the Bible. And the wise man, the preacher says, doesn't get involved in plots against the king. Because to do that is to put yourself in danger. You see that he does whatever he pleases. But he doesn't just do whatever he pleases. The last bit says, "For the word of the king is supreme, and who may say to him, 'What are you doing?'" So this king can't be questioned about what he's doing. He's not being held morally accountable by him, by anyone, sorry. And he adds this in verse 11. He says, because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily, the heart of children of man is fully set to do evil. John Enric Edward Bolberg Acton, that's an incredible name, isn't it? And he famously said, you'll know the quote if you don't know the name, power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men. We might think he's a bit of a cynic, but it is true that one of the greatest problems with the world is the temptation to abuse. Sorry, one of the greatest problems with power, not the world, with power is the temptation to abuse it for your own gain. When there's no one who can stand against you, there are no consequences for what you do, even if you do the worst thing that you can, at least not immediately, and so it corrupts. And we can see that, can't we? If we look back even at the last 100 years, we can see this clearly in the shape of people like Hitler or Stalin. But what do you do when power is abused like this? Well, our preacher says three things. Firstly, he says, make a stand in the right way at the right time. Verse 5, whoever keeps a command will know no evil thing, and the wise heart will know the proper time and just way. The preacher doesn't just say, do nothing. He says, if you're going to do something, it must be done at the right time and in the right way. And as I was thinking about this week, Daniel came into my mind. Here's this young man who goes to Babylon to live under this tyrannical king, Nebuchadnezzar. And he doesn't just run. He doesn't plot to kill the king. No, he stays, doesn't he? And he's blessed and he prospers there. But he does remain distinct, doesn't he? He doesn't assimilate with the Babylonian religion. He protects his faith. You'll remember he and his friends choose to eat food, vegetables, rather than eat the meat that had been sacrificed to idols. He doesn't bow down and worship the king. He continues to pray to God even when it's been banned. He makes a stand for all matters that relate to his faith or impinge on his faith. So that's the first thing. The second thing is to persevere. Verse 6, for there's a time and a way for everything. A little man's troubles lie heavy on him, for he does not know what is to be, for who can tell him how it will be? No man has power to retain the spirit or power over the day of death. There is no discharge from war, nor will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. He returns to the same theme we looked at first this evening, to death. There's only one thing that is sure about our future, that people die, that everyone dies. Whether you're the greatest guy in the world or the biggest tyrant in history, you're going to die. There's no amount of wicked gain that can save you from this fate. So what's the preacher's encouragement amidst all of this? It's going to end. It won't last forever. And then thirdly, trust God for justice and enjoy life. Verse 12, though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God, because they fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, neither will he prolong his days like a shadow, because he does not fear God. There is a vanity that takes place in the earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I say that this is also vanity. What is the preacher saying here? Well, there seems to be some wrestling going on in his mind. With the wisdom that he knows, he's saying to himself, God is just, he will be just in the way he deals with the righteous people, with those who fear him, and he will be he will judge well with the people who are against him, who fear him. And yet, on the other hand, he looks around him and he sees suffering and injustice happening everywhere. He says that sometimes it's those people who fear God who seem to get the raw deal, and those who have no regard for God at all, the sorts of people like the tyrannical king that he has in mind, they seem to be blessed with material wealth. It's that unanswerable question again. It's Hevel. He says it can't be grasped. It's like a breath. God is just, and yet I see injustice everywhere. What does he do? Does he lose faith in God's justice? No. Verse 15, the refrain, we've seen it before. He says, and I commend joy, for man has nothing better under the sun but to eat and to drink and be joyful, for this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. We've already seen that wisdom is good, that it should be pursued, but that it's got its limits. We can't grasp why some things work the way they do, or why some things happen the way that they do. And the preacher says to us, don't get caught up in the pursuit of absolute knowledge about everything and fail to enjoy what God has given to you. You see, life is confusing. It's complex. But there are things like food and drink and work which God has given us to enjoy. Don't miss out on life when you can't answer the unanswerable, or death stares you in the face, or when power is abused. Enjoy what God has given to you. Let's just think about living wisely again when we see power abuse. I don't think, though we might not like our government, and certainly quite a few people don't like our government given the protest rallies that have happened down south, and maybe they do abuse power, like the expenses scandal and things like that. But actually, we're in a privileged position. We can get rid of them after 5 years if they do these things. I wonder if we shouldn't apply this a little bit closer to home, a little bit more to the everyday, to our workplaces and in our community. I'd say that we see injustice there just as readily as we see it on the larger national scale. Things like when you're asked to do something unjust by your boss, something which is a little bit dodgy. Or perhaps one of your colleagues is being bullied. Perhaps in your neighborhood, that old lady who lives at the end of the street, she's being terrorized by the local youths or something like that. There is a right time, there is a right way to stand up to the abuse of power. But this is the thing that's really struck me this week as I thought about it. This is the real challenge. I think that often as Christians, we stand up at the right time, perhaps, but we don't stand up in the right way. I think Christians seem to be known for what they don't do and what they disagree with, rather than what they live for. And what happens, I think, is that Christians often come across as being judgmental and unloving. Is that really the right way for us to stand up? Surely the right way is to be filled with grace and mercy and love. After all, that's what we've been shown in Jesus. So there's loads of questions that we could think about as we close, but I just want us to think about three. And firstly, again, do I know that Jesus, my living in light of him, has relationship with him changed the way I live? Am I pursuing that godly character we spoke about? Am I surrounding myself with people who will challenge me when I need it? Am I living now in the present with a certain hope for the future? Then secondly, do I find my identity in wisdom, or do I find my identity in Jesus? And then a third thing, are there things in my workplace or in my community that I need to make a stand against? And what does it look like for me to do that in the right way and at the right time? So let's maybe take a couple of minutes, consider these, then Richard will lead us in our final hymn, and I'll close in prayer.